From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. Imagine launching a business before you even have products to sell, or imagine opening up a theater without having any actors for the play. Well, in a sense, Oregon's brand new WNBA team, the Portland Fire, are doing just that. They recently announced their inaugural season schedule, even though they don't have as yet any players. Today on the show, we check in with our colleague at OPB, Kyra Buckley, about the status of the Fire and how they're under the gun to put a team together before the start of the next season. Then, we'll talk with two of our reporters about what it's like to cover recent protests in our community, including one that turned violent. That's all next on Oregon on the Record. Right now, if the brand new Portland Fire of the WNBA played a game, the score at the end would be about 100-0 against Oregon's hometown team. Reason being, because the Fire have yet to hire any players. We talk now with our colleague at OPB about how the franchise is busily trying to put a team together. Kyra Buckley, reporter up at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Kyra, so great to talk to you. How are things?
Oh, so good. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, I'm excited because with so much bad news going on in the world today, it's great to talk about some good news. And you had a great story about the Portland Fire and the fact that they released their schedule. And boy, I hope you saw the Portlandia, the two Fred Armiston and Kerry Brownstein doing that great little bit they did. Did you see that?
I did. It was really fun. And if you are a fan of Portlandia, or even if you've just seen an episode or two, I think you will really enjoy it. And of course, if you're a women's basketball fan, you will notice a very famous player making an appearance
at the
end.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's great. Just Google it. Just Google Portlandia and Fire. I'm sure you'll see it. It's really funny. But they release a schedule, even though they don't have players yet, but just talk about sort of the schedule and what sticks out to you.
Yeah, well, that I think that, as you mentioned, the first thing that stuck out is they are telling us when games are, yet Portland has no players on its team. That's the same case for the Toronto Tempo. That's the other expansion team coming in.
Yeah.
We'll get into that in a second. But okay, despite that, the WNBA and the Portland Fire went ahead with releasing their 44-game schedule for the 30th season of
wow.
the WNBA. So some things to note here in Portland that we can get excited about is that the first game is set for tip-off on May 9th. The Portland Fire will host the Chicago Sky. But I think a lot of fans will be looking for the second game of the season here in Portland. And that's going to happen on May 12th. That's when the New York Liberty come to play. And
guess what?
We don't know what's going to happen in free agency, but that is
yes.
Sabrina Ionescu's team.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt. So, you know, I think, again, folks are just excited to see that the season is at least planning to start on time in May. And if you're a Fire fan here in the state of Oregon, you have the opportunity to go to 22 games right here in Portland.
Yeah, that is very exciting. So it is strange how this has kind of been put together. So they have a management structure in place. They have a coach. They have a coaching staff. Talk about that. And then, of course, then we'll talk about, well, how do you go about picking a team, putting a team together?
Yeah, I think the folks at the Fire are doing the definition of controlling what you can control.
Okay.
So right now they are able to put together the business side of things and the coaching staff. It was a little bit of a tough rollout, though, for the Fire. It took them a little bit to really gain momentum. They brought in a president for the team who didn't stick around. They then hired what they're calling an interim president. But that person seems to be in place for the foreseeable future. And they have this really well put together management structure of folks that spent time on the most recent expansion team, the Golden State Valkyries, have come up to Portland. Also, the coach, Alex Rama, is just very well known in the kind of innovative basketball world. And then, of course, for the coaching side, again, we have Sylvia Fowles, a two-time Olympic gold medalist who took a position as assistant coach for the Fire. So really, they've put together this kind of star-studded staff ready to go. And again, that's what the Portland Fire and their ownership group, that's what they can control right now, is those side of things. So they are moving full steam ahead as if the season will start on time in May.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You talked about some of the management from the Valkyries. And what's interesting to me, being a sports fan, is they got up and running in terms of being a quality product and winning games. That happened quickly for the Valkyries. Is there hope that the Fire can kind of duplicate that?
Yes, there is hope, okay. But the clock is ticking. And you're absolutely right. The Golden State Valkyries really set the bar high for an expansion team. And something that I've been following is ticket sales. And Golden State, really, they set the bar with close to 20,000 season tickets. The Portland Fire are at 15,000. So that says a whole lot about fans here in Portland being ready for basketball. But the Valkyries, they had a little bit more time. Yeah. They were able to run an expansion draft about 5 months before training camp. They had their roster in place. They had their coaching staff in place. So they were really ready to go when the 2025 season hit. And for reasons outside of their control, the Portland Fire, they are not quite that ready yet.
Let me reintroduce you to the audience, talking with my colleague, Kyra Buckley, up at OPB about the Portland Fire. Okay, so how do they build a roster?
Great question. So expansion teams to the WNBA have a couple ways to essentially get players in their locker rooms. And the first way is the expansion draft. And that's where they're able to choose players from other teams that don't have any restrictions. And that's the primary way that the Valkyries built their team. Then coming after that is free agency, where players that are not on certain contracts are able to entertain offers from other teams, including new expansion teams. And then, of course, there is the rookie draft, where they're drafting straight from college. And the WNBA is a little unique in that the draft for college players happens in April, and then training camp happens like a month later.
Wow.
So if you're drafted right out of college, you may be playing professional basketball the following month. So that's how you're able to build a roster as a new team. But as mentioned, the Portland Fire are in a unique position because they can't have their expansion draft yet.
Wow. That really does sound difficult. Does the WNBA provide the two expansion teams with the first pick in the rookie draft?
No, one would think, but no. I think many people that have probably followed a sports leagues know that there is some very complicated, complex way that draft picks are doled out and traded around. And while one would think it would make sense to give new teams the first pick, no, there's no guarantee. They'll be put in a lottery like other teams. Mm. So the Portland Fire are really waiting to see what's happening with the contract negotiations between the players' union and league officials. And once that contract is put in place, that's when they should be able to run the expansion draft. But right now, talks are stalled. We don't know when things will pick up again.
Can you remind folks, what are the big issues in trying to get this contract hammered out?
Yeah, so I want to assure everybody listening that the players are going to get paid more no matter how the contract negotiations fall, whether it is more what the league is proposing versus the players' union. So we're looking at big increases in salaries, but the sticking point is over how the WNBA will share revenue with the players. And the league has proposed kind of a complex formula of how they might share net revenue, and the players essentially want to be able to share in gross revenue, which would allow them to essentially capitalize on the growing popularity right now of the WNBA instead of potentially capitalizing on the growth and popularity 5 or 10 years down the road, which the players say that's what the league proposal would do. So they, both players and the league, say they want to see the season start on time. But we have not seen any movement that the two sides are coming closer together on that revenue sharing point.
So there is, hopefully very small, but there is a chance of a delay to the start of the season if they can't hammer this out.
Yeah, absolutely. There is. The players union has already authorized a strike if needed. That doesn't mean they are going to go on, but it is something the players are open to if an agreement doesn't come. But I will say that everything that I have seen from the league and from team owners, they do not want to do a work stoppage or a lockout. But again, we will not know until the basketball tips off in May.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, in sports and life and everything, timing is everything. People might remember there was a Portland fire. It didn't work out so well. Hopefully timing is better now and they can get the contracts worked out, because talk about how vital and vibrant the WNBA is now.
Yeah. I think that when the first iteration of the Portland fire was here, unfortunately, it came at a time when then the WNBA contracted and the team lost leagues. So much is different, 20 years later, where women's basketball in general is surging in popularity, partially because people have more access to watching it. Mm. They're able to see more WNBA games on TV. They're able to go to more college games. They're able to be exposed to it on a larger level. And also the culture around the WNBA, it's a predominantly Black league. It is led by queer women that are outspoken and talk a lot about things like pay inequity. And it's really coming at a time where culture is looking for that, and I think rooting for that. And there's a lot of folks that see themselves represented in the league and are really excited to go to games and to support not just the players in the game, but the culture around it. And the WNBA is capitalizing. They have seen more investments in recent years. They continue to break attendance records and viewership records. They're signing better TV deals. And there is just more ways for people to watch the WNBA. And that hopefully will bode well for the Portland Fire coming in at this time where there's just more eyeballs on the sport.
Yeah. Boy, you know, Breonna Stewart took a bold stance just this last few days about what happened in Minneapolis. And
yeah, absolutely. Breonna Stewart was protesting federal immigration enforcement. And that's just one issue we've seen players take up. There was massive player involvement in racial justice movements in 2020. Mm-hmm. And even before that, protests against police brutality in 2015, 2016, dare I say, before it was really part of the more popular culture, a lot of women's players, you know, they say like, hey, like we have always had to go against some sort of adversity. And so it just makes sense for us to stand up for the communities that we are a part of and that we care about. And I think that the public likes seeing people be their authentic selves. And that's what these players are offering.
Well, it's very exciting. And I'm sure that so many people cannot wait for the inaugural season. Whoever fills out the roster will be Kyra Buckley, a reporter at OPB. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now let's bring in our local reporters who've been covering multiple protests to get their perspective on what it's like at Ground Zero. Julia Bobach and Nathan Wilk, reporters for us here at KLCC. Really appreciate both of you coming in and talking.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks,
Michael,
for having us.
We have assigned both of you to go cover protests locally. And I want to talk about what it's like to cover a protest. It's very different than a standard interview. And Julia, I'm going to start with you because you had a story a couple days ago when you covered a protest. You know, and you're pretty new to this. So talk about the idea of, okay, I have a job to do. I've got to go get the story. but it's also a very unusual situation. Tell people why it's so unusual to have to go out and cover something where hundreds of people are there and emotions are running high.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a really interesting part of it from my perspective is just being a person in this huge crowd of people where everyone kind of blends in, but you're wearing headphones and you have a microphone in your hand. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, you know, my microphone is off when I'm walking around, but you definitely get looks of like, well, what's that? You know, who is that? Why are they doing that? But I think protest coverage has been really interesting for me because I think I've been very fortunate, I guess is the word, to be at protests that did not turn into anything bigger than people chanting and cars driving by and honking and signs being held. So I've really been able to get the stories about people who are there, why they decided to show up, and what it means to them to be at a place with so many people caring about the same thing.
Okay. Nathan, in your most recent coverage, kind of the opposite happened. Mm. It got out of control. And I want you to tell people about the most recent protest that you covered and tell us, you know, kind of what it was like to see it shift from a protest to something more.
Right. Well, you know, what I'll say first, Michael, is that covering a protest is often waiting around.
Sure.
You know, these events can be exceedingly long, and especially when we're talking about some of the anti-ICE protests where DHS responds, there's long periods of time where protesters are waiting to see if DHS comes out of the building, you know, but when people are detained inside, are they going to come out? When are they going to come out? That sort of thing. And, you know, what I've encountered is that with those DHS protests, the protesters themselves largely engage in pretty predictable ways.
Okay.
You know, banging on the buildings, the same sort of taunts and slogans at DHS officers. And really the question is how and when those inside the building respond to the federal law enforcement. So what happened at the recent protest, you know, by the time I showed up, there had already been an altercation between protesters and DHS in which two people were detained, I was told.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, throughout that day, there was a really big uptick in DHS coming out, sometimes at unpredictable times, interacting with protesters, taking more of them in the buildings. It was really sort of when protesters got really close to the doors and were kind of knocking and taunting and, you know, interacting with federal law enforcement that was on the roof and taunting them and that sort of thing. It was really like, okay, when and how is DHS going to respond? And so I was standing there watching them kind of inside the building when what appeared to be a flashbang or sounded like a flashbang, some sort of loud explosive noise happened. And that's the point where, you know, everything shifted, everyone ran, tear gas canisters came out. And so it can be those moments where the interaction between law enforcement and protesters happen that really the tone can swing so wildly.
Okay. Julia, you mentioned something on your first answer about you have equipment. Mm-hmm. You know, people, it's pretty easy to pick you out as someone who's not a protester, is not just a bystander. You're there as a reporter.
Yeah.
Does it create a tension for you that okay, people know who I am and they may not like the fact that journalists are here? Or do you find that it sort of in some ways erodes a bit of a barrier so that, okay, people know I'm supposed to be here because that's part of the game. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it easier to engage and talk to people and get their perspective.
That's an interesting question. I think at the beginning when I was walking around with the equipment, I was kind of getting looks that made me a little worried that I was overstepping in a way almost.
Okay.
Not to say that I was, because nothing I was doing was wrong, but just kind of a feeling of like, ooh, I don't know that people like that I'm here with this microphone in my hand. But the interesting thing is when I finally approached people, which is sometimes the hardest part because you don't want to bother people when they're really into this action and you also don't know how people will respond. All of the people that I interviewed like thanked me for being there.
Nathan, obviously you've covered a lot of protests fairly recently in your young career, but it's all happening in the shadow of what we're seeing in Minneapolis. People have been killed. There has been a tremendous uptick in violence. Do you think about that when you're out there covering a protest? Do you think, maybe even if you're not so much concerned about your own safety, is that something terrible can happen very quickly?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is scary. I mean, I spoke to someone last night who was sitting there with an ice pack over their eye, and somebody showed me a picture of what their eye looked like, and it was totally messed up. And, you know, it is scary. It is unclear what's going to happen. And you're sitting there for sometimes, again, like hours, unsure what's going to happen next, unsure if everything's going to sort of peter out or if there's going to be another sort of surge in activity. And then as a journalist, it's kind of complicated. I mean, there were several times throughout the night where I wanted to get closer and, you know, get photos of DHS or federal law enforcement, wanted to kind of see what protesters were doing, but sure. Didn't know, you know, when suddenly I'd have to be running away, you know. I think it's when you're putting yourself kind of up close, you are weighing the risks, right? Of, well, maybe I'll get the better shot. Maybe I'll get the better audio. Maybe I'll get clearer description for an article. You know, maybe I'll be the one getting hit with tear gas and, you know, I'm not going to be publishing anything good tonight. You know? From a personal perspective, it's hard to know exactly. And I think not having encountered something that has personally really injured me, I think it's easy to overlook the risks.
Sure.
And certainly when you're surrounded by, you know, any group of people, you don't want anybody to get hurt.
Well, Julia Bobach and Nathan Wilk, really appreciate the work that you do to cover these protests, and certainly appreciate you coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Monday on the show, Eugene's mayor, Karin Knutson, will join us to talk about the protests we've seen in our community and get her thoughts on how we might better come together to effect peaceful change. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.